is Mae Brussel. This is side two of tape number 379, March the 9th, 1979. I'll interrupt the Lebedev story, the book, for just 1 second to make a couple of announcements that may not get to you otherwise. Thanks to some New York listeners who subscribed to the tapes and who were followers on WBAI, I got a call from Lynn Samuels in New York City, and she's going to call me on March the 26th. That's 3 to 5 o'clock New York time, and we're going to do a show. That's quite a big victory. To get back on WBAI New York, they carried my tapes for several years, and I used to do many, many long shows with Bob Fass. And then I believe a COINTEL snow job came upon us, and Mark Lane put pressure on the station, and the tapes were taken off the air, and there was this big battle on the air about Mae Brussel and her information. And the station had a lot of reverses, lost a lot of money, lost their lease on 62nd Street, and it's been 2 years, I believe, since I've done anything with BAI in New York, and Lynn Samuels called, and one of the subscribers to these tapes sent her $20 for the telephone call because the station doesn't have the money. But that is great because I get a lot of letters from New York City, and she will promote it and try to get the listeners that used to follow Dialogue Conspiracy. So call your friends and in New York City tape that broadcast and call in and ask questions, and let's get that New York audience back, and maybe we can start making that a weekly or monthly call, possibly, back to WBAI. And also on KXRX in San Jose, I'll be back there March the 6th, the same day. This is 9 to 12 at night with Lynn Ryder, and I've enclosed the information for you on that. And call in if you have questions. Don't write to me and ask me. If you're in the area of San Francisco or San Jose and you can get on the air, call me. I believe this is the fifth in a series, once a month, with Lynn up in KXRX. That's 3 hours of radio time to answer your questions, anything you want to know, and to tell new people about the tapes. So be sure and call in. And starting in April, I'll be back at KPFA once a month with Mom O'Shea. We've done 3 or 4 shows, and this is fundraising time there if you want to send some money in and tell her thank you for having Mae Brussel. And as soon as the month is over, and if they raise the funds, that's up to you and all the people who listen to the show to send in money if they like that kind of programming. I'll be back at KPFA, so I'll be doing monthly shows, and then back at KGO in San Francisco. Bob Trevor is in the Soviet Union right now on a vacation, but hopefully when he gets home, we can get back there. If you call him and send him letters and call the station, they like to hear from you, then I'll be back with Bob again. But we will have these regular spots, and I hope the BAI can become a regular spot as it was before in New York City. So the rest is up to you. The stations like you to call. They like you to write to the station managers. They like you to call when we're on the air. And that's all it takes, is for you to put that energy into it, and then these radio shows will keep rolling along. Well, back now to Michael Lebedev and Treason for My Daily Bread, the book that I am reviewing with you, and you have the address here. You can order them. There are several copies at Research, at Box 1107 in Aptos, California, at 95003. Whoever writes first, Tom Davis, I think, has 2 or 3 copies that his brother brought over from England, and that's all. So if you're on the run and you want the book, write to him or write to the publisher in England. Well, Martin Bormann, back to their interesting escape. The fourth part of the book has to do with the escape of Michael Lebedev with Martin Bormann, and they're going down to Paraguay, and they have the assistance of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. That's a gentleman that worked with Adolf Hitler through the war, who organized the Muslims in the Middle East for Adolf Hitler, and I've given you the name of a book which I have, The Mufti and the Fuhrer, which is an interesting book on the background of the Grand Mufti. He sent an agent to Lebedev and Bormann, and this agent carried them through their trip. Interesting enough, they went with a group, the Haganah group. The Jewish refugees were sailing out of Italy over to Palestine, and they passed as 3 leaders of Jewish intelligence, and the Jews didn't know that on that ship was the notorious Martin Bormann, who probably with Adolf Hitler and Heydrich was behind these exterminations of the many, many millions and the reason for their displacement and survival. In the first place, they didn't know that on that ship with them, going to Palestine, were three men, one a representative of the Grand Mufti, the other Lebedev, and also Martin Bormann. And then when they got into Palestine, the next story is their jump over to South America, where Martin Bormann is settled, thanks to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. They're taken to Paraguay in South America, and that's where Martin Bormann goes. Now, he gives Lebedev an assignment, which is an iffy assignment, considering his background, that he suspected him originally of being a Russian agent, and he sends him into the Soviet Union to find out how many anti-communists are working there, part of the Galen operation after the war, to check out the anti-communist activity, how many supporters they have inside the Soviet Union. So Lebedev leaves South America, Paraguay, to go up to Russia, and when he gets into the Soviet Union, he loses his papers. He doesn't have the identity or the letters that he had when he was younger to prove who his father was. And he gets off the train to go to his hometown, to look over the hometown where he was born and raised. And he leaves the train station, and the Russian police pick him up and suspect him because he's broken off from the regular group. And they give him a very short hearing, which isn't even a trial. And they send him to a concentration camp in Russia. They suspected him for spying on them, which is really, in fact, what he was sent to do by Bormann. But he didn't even have time to get to the KGB to tell of his experiences with Martin Bormann. He was sent to Bormann in the first place by the Soviets, and he never had a chance to get to them, and they wouldn't believe him. So they put him in this camp for 15 years, and he thought that he would be there for life and would never get out, and he tells the details of the Russian camp and the hardships. But after 15 years and all the paperwork and his allegations of his father and his background, and that he was actually sent by the Soviets to spy on Bormann in the first place, they came across his papers in the Russian bureaucratic scheme, and they released him, and they took him back and gave him clothing and shelter, and realized that he had been on their side, that he was a Russian that was sent to the Nazis in the first place, and they forgave him for not staying with the Russians at the time that the war was over, because he would have been killed by the Germans right then. He had no choice. But he was bounced around. The story gets a little complicated, and I'm trying to simplify it. It's logical if you follow what Michael Lebedev is saying. He was caught in both camps. He was in Germany when the war was over, and there was no way for him to stay behind and meet the Russians. The Germans were going to shoot him on the spot. And just as kidnappers use somebody in front of them as a foil, you know, the person they've kidnapped would be shot first, his life was worth nothing if he didn't leave with Bormann. And he knew that he wouldn't get 5 miles out of town because he knew the money and the power behind the operation, the Nazis that were leaving, so he had to go with Bormann. And as soon as he set his foot in Russia, they didn't believe him. And then they said, okay, prove it to us. If you didn't come to spy on us, prove it to us by going back to Bormann and telling us how strong is the Bormann Brotherhood, the Nazi spy operation that's operating today. So the Soviets sent him back into the arms of Bormann down in South America, and he was literally tossed from place to place. He was a person whose father had died 2 months before he was born. He had served both sides. He had been trained by a Russian system and the KGB for 5 years to infiltrate the Germans. When the war was over, they literally kidnapped him and took him as a barrier to protect them, and then sent him on a job which imprisoned him, and then his captors released him if he went down to South America. And then, of course, Bormann takes advantage of the man and tests his loyalty, because, again, he still has the machinery to kill him. So he tests him, and he says, okay, I'm going to give you an assignment. You can leave Paraguay, and I want you to go in to New Orleans. And he gives him an assignment to go to New Orleans, which eventually ends up at Dealey Plaza. And Michael Lebedev claims that Bormann knew all along that he was on a conveyor belt. There was no road out at any point of the turn, and as he says, he was always 50 feet from death if he made the wrong move. So he's, after meeting with Bormann, he proceeds to New Orleans, and he's given a long list of names of persons he describes as Nazi ideology. He travels under the guise of being a Swiss engineer with a passport, Miguel Lobedo, L-O-B-E-D-O, and said that he had European and Cuban blood. He doesn't go into the German background or the Russian background, but this time he's traveling as a Swiss. It's interesting, when he went down to Paraguay to find Bormann the second time, when they went to locate him, he was under the name of Dr. Jung. And the new book on Dulles tells about the influence of Dr. Jung, the psychiatrist, upon Alan Dulles and his family, and it was sort of a turning point in Alan Dulles going into mind control for the CIA immediately after World War II, and during this whole period he was interested in mind control, and Dr. Jung was a name that Bormann was using down in South America. So Bormann sends him to New Orleans with his passport, and he's given an address, 107 Decatur Street, New Orleans, to see David Ferry. He goes there, and it's the wrong address. He goes to 117, and it's a bar. The people at the bar know him, and they tell him to go to Camp Street and ask for Guy Bannister at 544 Camp Street. And, of course, that's the address that Lee Harvey Oswald also used in New Orleans. And when he gets inside the building, he asks for Guy Bannister and mentions David Ferry's name, and the gentleman looks at him and says that he, in fact, was David Ferry in the office at that time. The way they were to meet was that he was to say, "I am Miguel Lobedo. I'm interested in assessing the strength of the anti-communist feelings in the southern states." Of course, Wernher von Braun, the Nazi, who should have been tried as a war criminal, who escalated our space and satellite systems, was in Alabama, Muscle Shoals, Alabama, has been named in the Torbett document as part of the assassination team. And Dornberger's crony was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Michael Dornberger, and of course the whole rim, the southern rim, from California to Arizona, New Mexico, even Nevada and Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Miami, Louisiana, was filled with pro-Nazi, anti-communist sympathizers. David Ferry, he says, was a cover for the Central Intelligence Agency, and he spoke of his friend, a Colonel Orloff, who was interested in this survey of anti-communists, and it was Colonel Orloff who was with George de Morenchil, as I mentioned, visited Marina Oswald the first time de Morenchil met Marina. Orloff was with her. We don't know how many times, whether he saw her two times or 200 or just that once, but Orloff was with Marina Oswald and worked with David Ferry and George de Morenchil. And then the colonel introduced himself as being part of a small white Russian community throughout the southern states, and a group called the White Russian Emigres in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that I identified years ago as belonging to Reinhard Gehlen's operation, Hitler's intelligence chief, a Nazi, that worked with Alan Dulles. He goes into a home in Dallas to a party, and he meets various anti-Castro persons and anti-communists, and a Mr. Clay. He refers to him as K-L-E-E, but translated or explained later in the book, he was referring to Clay Shaw. But Mr. Clay is the friend of Colonel Orloff and also David Ferry. And they talk about Ruth. He hints about this woman, Ruth, and I'm sure that they must mean Ruth Payne, who was close to Marina and de Morenchil, and, as I say, her husband with Walter Dornberger. That's the home where Oswald was the night before the assassination, and left there and went to the Texas School Book Depository. And Ruth Payne was the woman who called Roy Truly and asked for a job for this person, and he was placed in that building where he could be a patsy, because the motorcade was decided much later. October 15th, Ruth Payne called Roy Truly, and October 16th, Lee went down there and began his employment in the Texas School Book Depository. They would later set him up as the decoy and the patsy. They talked about the Arab operations there and the anti-communist links, and of course, the CIA foundations that were exposed in 1967 mentioned the Friends of the Middle East and the Arab connections of John Connolly and the various oil people that I listed off earlier on the other side of the tape. He refers to these Arab operations. And he met Guy Bannister, the gentleman who worked in Chicago with Robert Mayhew in the FBI, who set up the assassination teams in 1960, and then moved, Mayhew set him up with the CIA, and then Guy Bannister had worked with him in Chicago and had a detective agency in New Orleans where David Ferry worked, and Oswald chaired the offices, and Lebedev noticed that there was no evidence of it being a detective agency. It was just a front for this other operation that later turned out to be Permandex and the assassination teams. He said David Ferry and Guy Bannister were taking orders from someone much higher up. And one day he was told, Lebedev was told by these men, we're going off to Dallas, but first you're going to Shreveport, Louisiana, to a motel that's run by one of us. We're going to pick up another man at the motel. Lebedev had been sent by Borman to these people, and what they said was, we are going to Dallas. They went to Shreveport and met a man about 28 to 30 years old, who is Zed, who he describes as the man who shot the 45, the fatal headshot to John Kennedy. And they got acquainted in this motel, which was a CIA safe house. And he tells how they got instructions for the assassination for their role, not anything doing with Lee Harvey Oswald in the building or a man in the Daltex building or on the roof of the building. This has nothing to do with other assassins. Michael Lebedev wrote this in 1966 from just his own experiences with these people, all that he knew, and then when I read you his conclusion, that's what he feels about the assassination, and this is the role he's had. He said that their instructions for the assassination were not printed, and they weren't given on the telephone. They were on a tape recorder, and they opened up a package, and they listened to the tape, and the tape said, listen carefully, and make no notes, and memorize every detail, and know your assignment. And it said, it's your assignment, it's not a choice. And the tape goes on and says, we know the background of both of you. In the case of Zed, he was a child brought up in England who had a very strict father who used to beat him and whip him, and they had a fight, and Zed had killed his father and left England. And, of course, Lebedev had this role of working for Martin Bormann and also having been in the prison camps in Russia, tossed back and forth by the two systems and trained as a spy against the Nazis and then sent back by Bormann to spy against the Russians. So they had the background of both men, and the tape supplied the background and said, in quotes, we can ensure your death. You're not free to travel 50 feet from here. You will be supplied with one round of ammunition. And Lebedev wrote that the Borman assignment to go see David Ferry was a ploy to get him here in the Shreveport Hotel to meet Zed, and that Zed led him to Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas. In the hotel room at Shreveport, they were given a replica of Dealey Plaza, a little figurines, I guess, made up showing the trees, the fence, where they were to stand. It was a model, and it was for target referral with all kinds of instructions. And then Zed was to wear a headpiece. Now, Lebedev wasn't to do anything but to escort him there, sort of to watch over him and make sure he did his job. To wear a headpiece and take their firing position, and it was marked, I guess, gauged off from where John Kennedy's car would make that detour down the street in the visible stop where they could get a crossfire at that particular moment. And the firing position was marked by an automobile, which was parked at the spot in back, and they were to go find this car and park, see this car, and have a headpiece that was to be delivered 1 hour before the zero. 1 hour before Kennedy was to be killed, a headpiece would be brought to them by some men, and the salary was $20,000 for one of the men and $30,000 after the successful conclusion, after John Kennedy got that headshot from over by the fence. Lebedev said there was no way out of it. They were totally trapped, and he'd been in similar situations like this, it seems, all of his life since being trained in the Soviet Union and sent to Germany in the higher echelons of the German government. And he had to go through with the appointed task because there is no way of running away. They find you and find you at borders or airplanes or car rentals. There's no way to hide and nowhere to go and nowhere to run. He implies that the Borman Brotherhood catches up with you. And when you fail or you know too much, you're gunned down. And certainly the list of about 130 witnesses now to the John Kennedy assassination, such as Robert Mayhew's his hired underlings like John Rosselli and Sam Giancana, and even high-up men like Carlos Prio Siqueiros and Clay Shaw and Guy Bannister and so forth are dead. So what Lebedev is saying is true, and he knew that. And he said he couldn't carry with him any evidence, no notes, no directions. Nothing was done. They had to memorize it from the tape and learn it. And he talked with Zed in the motel room and got his background, as I say, having killed his father. And Zed said that he had no fear of the consequences. He had no pangs of conscience, and that it was just a job to be done. He saw a target and a crosshair. He squeezed the trigger, and his motive was simply that whenever he killed some man, he was killing his father, and he'd had a miserable life, and it was a way of making a buck, and that's the way he did it. He earned his money, and he was well-trained, and the book doesn't go into where Zed departed with Lebedev. They split up after the job was done, and it doesn't tell if Zed went back and collected his $20,000 that was promised him, or whether he was murdered, or maybe he went on to other places to do other assassinations. That isn't clear, and he doesn't try to pretend to know where Zed is. He just knows that he worked with him, and they were committed. And he said, "I stood committed to an act for which I had neither the motive or the stomach, but I was committed just the same." And the commitment that they use is just simply survival. And if it isn't him, as he said, it would be somebody else. So he went with it. And they went to the fence at Dealey Plaza, where they were instructed, and Zed got out an automatic revolver. He says it was a .45, that Zed doesn't like to use rifle, never has used a rifle. He uses a .45, and he said to him very clearly, "I shan't miss, not at this range. I'm not a rifle man. I never have been, but this is going to be easy." A station wagon moves into the parking area in front of the railroad track, and they felt the wagon was surveying them. There was some controversy about a station wagon picking up Lee Harvey Oswald in front of the Texas School Book Depository after the assassination, but we don't know if it's the same station wagon or not. That wagon belonged to Ruth Payne, because he has no detail about the station wagon. Maybe he didn't realize how important it was at the time. The color of it or the model didn't seem to catch his fancy. It was just the fact that he felt they were under surveillance all the time and that the station wagon would pull up. And Zed said, "One way or another, it's the end of the road for me." He felt it was, and he felt that he should. He said, "I reckon I'd have been smart to stop up there in the Windy City instead of coming south. But it sounded like a good idea, and by the time I found out of what sort of a deal it was too late. It's too late for wishing. There's no going back to Shook," meaning Chicago. Now, as I say, this is where the assassination plan was to take place. It was November 1st, 1963, and it was called off. And it's hard because there are no documents here to evaluate what Lebedev is saying. But it seems that this Zed was going to be one of the gunmen, and we know that a man named Lee Harvey Oswald, not the same one in the Dallas-Fort Worth area who had a car, was involved in the Chicago plot. As a matter of fact, Sherman Skolnick sent out some literature about this that I might go into next week on the tape with you on the Chicago plot. And so the shooting took place. The car went down the street and Dealey Plaza, and he pulled that .45, and he could hear other shots at the same time, just about the same time. And hit it right on target, and the two men split. And Lebedev didn't collect his money. He went to a car agency. He had some money on him, and he bought a truck, and he got some blue jeans and disguised himself and traveled south and got out of the country and went to Beirut, where he was living from 1963 until 1966, when he had completed this manuscript and put it in the hands of this book publisher, who then decided to get it out in 1976-77, and I first heard about it in 1978. It's hard to evaluate all this material. It's hard to digest it and say, is Michael Lebedev telling you the truth? There was a Buddy Walters, a Dallas policeman, who picked up a .45 caliber slug over there at the grassy knoll where Zed was supposed to be located. He turned it to the Dallas Police Department. It was never used by the Warren Commission. Lebedev says that he and Zed were picked up as suspects and taken off by the Dallas police because they were on the scene. They pretended they were going after the alleged assassin and acted like they were running in the direction of the police looking for them, but they were picked up as suspects And they were taken into the police department, and then they said, oh, we have the assassin. It's Lee Harvey Oswald. And the suspects were released, and their names weren't taken, so that he was allowed to leave town. He had that kind of cooperation, and he implied that that's how high up the conspiracy is, that he had that kind of cooperation. And I've listed for you on the sheet here some information that would confirm what Lebedev is saying, but which I think would be difficult for him to have had in 1966 when he wrote this. If he wrote this book in 1979, it would be different because of, say, so many radio tapes I have out and so many books that are out and published manuscripts. But there's certain characters here that line up to what he was saying in 1966 that, even though he was working on a need-to-know basis, could confirm some of the things and he was saying. He talks about J. Edgar Hoover and his complicity as the man who thought he was doing the right thing and knew differently. And there are links of J. Edgar Hoover to Meyer Heydrich and Martin Bormann and Interpol and the Nazi connections. He doesn't mention Albert Osborne, but Osborne had a school for assassins, and Zed, who he meets in Shreveport, comes from nowhere but is a very well-trained assassin, knows what he's doing, he's cool. They simply meet at a hotel, and they're given their lesson, and Zed goes off very cold-blooded and not embarrassed and knows it's a salary, and it could be that Zed came from the same kind of a missionary as these trained assassins that Albert Osborne ran, because Osborne worked with Clay Shaw and David Ferry and Permandex. His home base was Tennessee and Alice, Texas. But Zed could have come from that establishment, and being as the Warren Commission and G. Robert Blakey's group didn't look into Albert Osborne connections, we're 15 more years away if ever they get into that. We know the Vatican did write papers for Martin Bormann, and that he was housed, disguised as a monk, and then housed as a missionary and secluded in a garden reading books and so forth, and went over the Brenner Pass and stayed there and left with papers and documents to go to South America. Ladislo Ferrago wrote his book Aftermath, The Search for Martin Bormann, in 1974, where he describes the route that was taken out of Italy, that the Vatican helped him leave from Germany and out of Italy. So there's no way that Michael Lebedev could have had this information in 1966. There were also Nazi connections of Jean de Morenschild and George de Morenschild and the Bormann Brotherhood to Lee Harvey Oswald and Ruth Payne, as I said before, working her husband working for Walter Dornberger, and Clay Shaw, the Clay he talks about, working with Reinhard Galen and Galen's agents. The story of Permandex and the Tormod document didn't come out till 1972. This book was published in 1977, or began to be printed in 1977, and whether it was updated or not by persons other than Michael Lebedev and changed from the 1966 manuscript, we'll never know. Did they take a story that he wrote and then put in these stories based upon other books? That's the unknown question. It came out a long time after it was given to this particular publisher, but I can see why. His message was very strong in 1966, and certainly by 1977, the story of America and the assassinations and the questions about the assassinations that were being raised would make it more interesting to publish at that late date. But there's no way of knowing if the manuscript was updated with the new information that came out, or whether Lebedev had that early information a long time ago. There's no way of knowing what's in his head or to follow that through, and that is an unknown question. And I know that there are these Nazi connections. I know that Buddy Walters did pick up a .45 slug. There are too many interesting parallels or facts that overlay this that he had no way of knowing. And it's an interesting story, Treason for My Daily Bread. If you can get it, I don't know if it's in the library. You might ask them to get it. You can order it or buy it. But because there are so many links to the Nazis, I thought I should spend one whole tape sharing this with you. Next week, we'll get back to an update of the news. There's so many things happening. I just wish we had an hour a week. I say that every week, but we don't have. But we'll update the news. And if you want to get this book, you can. But this, in essence, is what it's about. And I think I've taken the major parts out for you. And I hope it's understandable. It's hard. And one-hour tape to tell you all the intricacies of his life that was a complicated life, or his motivation for being in the places that he was. But it is all logical and can be explained and seems to make sense. And in the end, you feel very sorry for Lebedev, and yet you appreciate that if he's telling the truth, it's so that we can have a better country, and he seems to be pleading for that. And he's pleading for all of you out there to make changes, and don't worship these people that are doing these things, but take them off their pedestal, kick out from under them the glory that they get for doing these things, and expose them for the murderers that they are. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and I'll be with you next week. Take care and have a good week.